May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sabha Buddha Nubhavena Sala Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Dhamma Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sava Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the sanghas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Let's take a short stretch break and then get together for a talk and some discussion. So welcome back, everybody. This is a time that we set aside for any announcements of any upcoming Dharma-related activities, either in the Sangha or in general. And so, does anyone have anything they'd like to share?
So I have a quick one. Tara Lloyd noted that September 5th was Labor Day weekend. So we'll start meeting on September 12th in person rather than September 5th. And we're still looking for volunteers for setup and takedown if anybody is wanting to help out with that. Thank you.
Okay. And as we've done every year for many years now, we'll also be offering the introductory series on Foundations of Mindfulness every Sunday in October. And we'll be wanting to do some outreach around that, you know, some advertising, getting the word out. So if anyone has thoughts about venues to post that or anything like that, please be sure to let us know. We're really looking to, looking forward to being able to come together again in person to the extent that circumstances allow. And of course, given what the future may hold in store in terms of viruses in our lives. Okay, anything else?
Are we meditating on the 5th?
Yes.
Oh, well, we're going to meet, just not in person. That begins the weekend after Labor Day.
So, Tara Lloyd, are you okay with me recording this?
Please do. Yeah, please do.
It'll make that noise.
Recording in progress.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right. So the title of the theme for my talk and discussion this evening is Denial, Friendship, and Recovery. And you can sort of think of that like almost like a formula. Denial plus friendship, you know, courageous friends can lead to recovery. So that's what I'm going to be talking about this evening. So the Buddha's teachings on, you know, the ennobling truths of the reality of suffering, its causes, means by which it may be brought to an end, that cessation is possible, and the means by which to do it. When he took it down to the next power on the microscope, you know, let's have a closer look at what constitutes the suffering. And he described the three primary causes as torments of the mind, the three poisons: strong aversion, craving and clinging, that's the second one. And the third one is delusion, or ignorance, or denial, choosing not to see something that is there. So they all have a role to play. They're all interactive and reinforcing. But in some ways, delusion can be seen as perhaps the most pernicious. And the reason it is that it prohibits the mind from being able to see the truth of the extent to which our consciousness is driven by aversion and by craving. And so it's not possible to begin to become free of these forms of self-inflicted suffering if you don't know that they're there, or you don't see their full extent. And in the Indian epic, the Mahabharata, there is a story. You know, it's this very long saga. It's one of the classics of Indian Vedic literature, very early literature, about this struggle, about forces vying for control of society and for control of the world. And in the Mahabharata, in one of the sort of chapters or segments of it, there is the story of these five noble brothers, the Pandava brothers. And they are temporarily on the short end of the stick, on the losing side of one of these battles, and they get banished to the forest and they become separated. And the oldest of these brothers is Yudhishthira, and he's sort of the leader of the pack as well. You know, he's looked to because he's sage and smart and courageous and whatnot. So the brothers get banished to the forest, and they become separated. And so Yudhishthira sets off in trying to find his brothers, tracking them through the forest. And he comes to this lake, and around the lake, he sees the bodies of his brothers. They've all drunk from the lake. They got there and they were thirsty and they drank from the lake. But the lake had been poisoned by Yamaraja. Yamaraja in the Mahabharata and the Vedic literature is the Lord of Death. Okay. And the Lord of Death, when Yudhishthira comes and sees his dead brothers, Yama says, "I will put to you an inquisition, 100 questions. In conversational style that you must answer. If you answer them all correctly, then you will live and become eventually a king. If you answer them incorrectly, I will cast a spell on you so that you drink from the same waters as your brothers and die. Yama being Yama, Yudhishthira doesn't have a lot of choice in the matter. And so they begin this conversation, and he answers all the questions correctly, and they get to the last question. And Yama asks Yudhishthira, what's the most amazing thing in the world? And he looks around him, his dead brothers and other dead people and animals and whatnot lying around this poison lake as well. He says that we can see death all around us and yet believe it will not happen to ourselves as well. And the answer is correct, of course. And Yudhishthira goes on to become a successful noble king. So, why do I begin with this story? Well, five years ago or so, when I retired from my professorship at the University of Colorado, I also began to transition from being an occasional drinker of alcohol to a habitual daily drinker of alcohol. And the pattern became more and more pronounced over time. Through the pandemic and afterwards, the dependency just became greater and greater. And I went to considerable lengths to hide my dependency out of guilt and shame, tried to set up parameters with which I could control it. One of the parameters that I chose was that I would never, under any circumstances, teach the Dharma under the influence of alcohol. And 2 weeks ago, on the evening of July 11th, I violated that parameter. Everyone else I know who's been in recovery or is in recovery now tells their story about what it finally took for them to awaken from denial of the extent of their addiction. For me, it was that event. It was like the moral equivalent of driving drunk and hitting someone with my car. I breached a sacred trust. I did harm to the Dharma, the Sangha, and to myself. To shook my self-confidence to the core. So by the next morning, when I felt that the full force of what I'd done, I realized that I had come to a very important crossroads. The crossroads was that I had to either get sober or stop teaching the Dharma. Basically as simple as that, right? As simple as that, not as easy as that, but as simple as that, okay? So I realized I had to do more than I had been, because for almost a year I'd already been being seen at one-on-one counseling for alcoholic use disorder at the VA Medical Center, but it wasn't effective, or obviously it wasn't effective enough. And so I began an intensive search for a group-supported recovery program that best aligned with my growing understanding of the nature of addiction and my own mind and my own values. And in this case, it turned out to be a program called Self-Management Recovery Training, or SMART Recovery, which I've been adhering closely to since starting it. The Thai meditation master Ajahn Chah described following the Theravada Buddhist path as learning to find and listen to the teacher within, the inner spiritual friend and counselor, what he called the one who knows. And it was very much in that same well-intended healing nature of my own consciousness that put me on the path to recovery. So not long after that, two friends in the Dharma friends in the Denver Sangha got in touch with me and said they'd like to meet. You know, they're also members of the Sangha Council. And there was some, you know, Sangha business to take care of, things having to do with going back to meeting in person and whatnot. But I figured there was probably another item on the agenda as well. Sure enough, you know, both of these Dharma friends from the Sangha have many years of experience in recovery from addiction to alcohol. And, you know, and they said, you know, are you in trouble? You know, are you having a problem? And, if, you know, of course, you know, they knew without having to ask the question. And it turned out to be a really rich and rewarding experience, and that I was being offered the same spiritual friendship and support that I'd been hoping to foster within the Sangha when I began teaching over 20 years ago. You know, it was, in some ways, it was like coming to full circle. The way the Denver Sangha first got started was over two decades ago, when I was just finishing my seminary program and starting to teach, and I was asked to come and give a presentation on mindfulness meditation at a non-residential retreat that was being hosted at the Isle of School of Theology by all of the Metro Denver area 12-step meetings. And so I did, and went and gave a talk, and I was getting ready to teach an introductory series after that, and so I had some flyers for that. And then when I went to present the series, it was very heavily attended by people who've been at the retreat. And I gave the four-part series, and then said, well, you know, Tia, it's been really nice seeing you in this class, you know. And you know, I said, well, you know, you don't understand. We go to meetings. When's the next meeting? So what started out as an introductory series became the Insight Meditation Community of Denver. We've been meeting every Sunday ever since, right? And so in some ways for me, it feels a little bit like coming full circle, you know, that was kind of how we got going, you know, as a Sangha. And now I'm finding that, you know, friends within that Sangha are the ones who are there for me when it's become my turn to acknowledge that I have an addiction problem and that I really need all the support I can get when it comes to recovery. So, fully awakening to the extent of what was going on for me, I felt quite a lot like Yudhishthira in the Mahabharata. My mom has struggled with, she's dead now, with a combination of mental health challenges and severe alcohol addiction for her entire adult life. Her sister, my aunt, had been a heavy drinker, and she eventually descended into alcoholic dementia, and I became her guardian. And she used to call me up and scream at me for, you know, not letting her do the things she wanted to do or spend her money the way she wanted to. When I went to visit her once, they sell liquor at the state store there in the little town on eastern North Carolina coast where she lived. And while I was there, I went into the state store to get myself, some bourbon. And was talking with the women that were working at the front desk, and it's a small town. Everyone knows everybody. I said, you know, I was there visiting Wayne. Said, oh, yeah, Miss Patricia. Said, she comes in here about once a week and buys a gallon of Captain Morgan rum, right? And I said, yeah, that's the one. And they said, you know, when they see her pulling into the parking lot, they tend to walk toward the back of the store in case she can't find a brake pedal. she had it pretty bad, and everybody knew it. My mom had a massive stroke when she was about 70. She lived out in Hawaii with, where my brother lives. And so we go out there to visit and hang with my brother. And we'd sit on the beach and knock back some Mai Tais, and we'd smoke some Maui Waui in the form of a blunt about the size of a Cuban cigar. And we'd say, yeah, wow, it's a real bummer about Mom, isn't it? My goodness gracious, you know, how we can see death all around us and yet not believe it will happen to us. So there it was. My own lack of awareness of the extent to which my increasing dependence was negatively affecting my relationships with my family is something that I've stayed kind of oblivious to. It's a little like being in denial of global warming, right? Until your house gets washed away in a flood or burned down by a wildfire. And for me, it had to take, you know, betraying a sacred trust to myself and the Sangha to realize that things are pretty bad, and they really needed some helping out, you know. So I think it was probably degrading my Dharma teaching in ways that I wasn't aware of also, since I was living in delusion and seeking to hide from a truth that needed to be seen. I sometimes experience real anxiety when I'm leading up to giving a Dharma talk, you know, and certainly this evening. Many years ago, I was out for a walk in a forest in the Berkshire Mountains with my friend and teaching mentor, Joseph Goldstein. I was there to assist him on a retreat that was being held for law professors and law students in October of 2001, right after the attack on the World Trade Center. And many of the people on this retreat had friends who were either killed or knew somebody who was, and he wanted me to teach metta at this retreat, and saying, I'm not sure how I can pull that off. And he basically said the same thing to me that the Buddha said to his followers. You know, he said, I would not ask you to do this if I did not think you could. He said, what you're voicing is self-doubt. And he said, it's good to, approach Dharma teaching with respect and a sincere effort to do your best. But don't let it get in the way of your being able to share the Dharma. It's a jazz musician named Herbie Hancock who said one time, you can play riffs, runs, and scales for 20 years and then get up on the bandstand and forget it all. So, for the whole 20 years I've been teaching the Dharma in our Sangha, it just happens. I just say, God, I hope I can adequately serve the Dharma tonight, you know, in the way I teach and the way, you know, in our discussions. And so I've endeavored to do so. And until this event occurred, it woke me up to the fact that I really needed to acknowledge truths that I had been avoiding, that I had been in denial of. And my decision to do that was really strengthened and supported and undergirded by, you know, meeting with friends from the Sangha. It's also seemed really important to me to tell the truth to you all, you know, in terms of exactly what's been going on. Because, you know, I've set out on the path of recovery, but who knows where it's going to lead or how long it's going to be or what I'll encounter along the way. But I did want to take this opportunity this evening to reaffirm to you that I will never again teach the Dharma under the influence of alcohol. If I suffer a lapse at some point and I'm impaired, then I'll just call in sick. I will not teach the Dharma when I'm under the influence of alcohol ever again. I owe it to myself, I owe it to the Dharma, and I owe it to you to be just as straightforward as I can about that. And then finally, I wanted to say, you know, one of the useful things that I've come across so far in this kind of science and psychotherapeutically based approach toward support of my group meetings toward recovery, you know, when I would think about drinking and why I didn't want to give it up, you know, I would have these really pleasant, sentimental memories. You know, my wife Abby and I lived in the Bay Area in East Bay in the 1970s and 80s when the wine industry in Napa and Sonoma Valleys was just really kind of getting up and running. And so you could both in the Bay Area and if you went up into the wine country, there are some really delightful wines at really affordable prices, you know, these crisp, dry Chardonnays in the summer and these spicy, dry, full-bodied Zinfandels and Cabernets in the winter. And I'd think about hanging out on the beach on the Big Island with my brother, you know, putting away my ties at sunset. And I kind of tended to forget about these kind of walking dead hangovers that I would also get from time to time, increasing frequency. And until I really started diving deep into the literature, the research literature on the neurophysiology of addiction. And when I started looking at that literature, you know, all the romance and all the fond memories and whatnot kind of fell to the wayside. And the effects of ethanol on the body, you know, this body of research paper said, you know, and right there in the abstract, it says, you know, ethanol is an addictive, carcinogenic neurotoxin when ingested into the human body. And so that one kind of stuck with me. So now whenever urges arise and you know, any sentimental memories of this or that wine or whatever come up, then this is the mantra that I started repeating to myself. Addictive, carcinogenic, neurotoxin. Scientifically, clinically, that's what it is, and that's the effect it has on the body and the mind-body process. And so it's awakening to that truth, you know, that clinical truth. And what I need to be doing insofar as my healing process is concerned and insofar as being acting with integrity toward myself, toward the Dharma, and toward you all, toward the Sangha, you know, requires staying awake to that truth. So wish me well. And I want to open it up for some discussion now, for any comments or reflections or questions that anyone might have, please. Gloria? Unmute, Gloria.
Sorry.
There you go.
Got it. I wanted to thank you, Terrell Lloyd. It means so much to, and as most people in the Sangha know, I'm in recovery and have been for a long time, and it's always welcoming to hear someone share their story. And that's what the program's been all about, sharing our strength and hope. And you put a boost in my recovery program. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. I mean, you're the veteran. I'm a complete newbie at this. So, you know, it's, every day is a new lesson how to do it.
You know, I went out after 12 years. My first period of sobriety was 12 years, and I managed to talk myself into, not only was I not an alcoholic, but that disease didn't exist. I mean, the arrogance that it took to get there, which is amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate both your courage and your forthrightness and, you know, my ability to learn from you. I look to you all who have more experience with this is, you know, yes, it can be done. And yes, relapses happen. My friend Kevin Griffin, who's written books about Buddhism and the 12 steps and whatnot, teaches in that area. He said that insofar as, you know, what eventually brought him to the point where he was able to essentially, you know, bring his addiction to an end or, you know, cease to have his life ruled by alcohol, that he got sober enough to be able to go on the 3-month retreat at Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, did the whole retreat, came away clean as a whistle, and was absolutely determined to never drink again in his life. And he said within about 6 or 8 months time, he was drinking more heavily than ever had before in his life. And it was that episode that very nearly killed him. And he had to come pretty close to the edge of losing his life before he was able to once again get back and get to work and clean it up. So, speaking of illusion, if you can go for a long period of time, be totally clean, figure the problems over, and then, there's this film from a lot of years ago called Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful film about martial arts and stuff. And I saw it with a Chinese-American friend of mine. And he was able to just take the whole film in because it was in Mandarin. And so I was busy watching the action and reading the subtitles at the same time. And the storyline in the film was about this young female martial arts student who is just a brilliant student, and she has two teachers. And allegorically looking back on it, it's kind of the dark side and the light side or whatever. And one of her teachers is, you know, the master of these incredibly powerful lethal arts that she teaches the woman. And then her other teacher is the one who focuses mostly on, you know, using your powers for good. And so, long story short, the woman, the teacher who's offering her lessons on the deadly arts, says, well, there's one thing you have to do to master these arts, and you have to fool your teacher, your other teacher, into thinking this isn't what you're doing. So at any rate, she goes about that deception, and it winds up taking the life of her other teacher, because the first teacher was deceiving her into basically setting up situations for him to be killed. And so as we left the movie, my friend was saying, wow, it's amazing how the title really encapsulates the storyline. I was like, duh, you know, because I had been trying to, you know, read and watch at the same time. And the Crouching Tiger was the enemy you can see, you know, the opponent that you're encountering in combat, right? The hidden dragon was the one she couldn't see. In that case, it was her ambition that resulted in the death of her other teacher. And so that formulation has kind of stayed with me as well. You know, there's the crouching tiger, you know, the addiction is like right there in front of you. The hidden dragon is the delusion, you know, that the deluded mind wants to take over. It wants to say, that was kind of a rough patch, but everything's hunky-dory now, no need to worry about it. And the hidden dragon's always there, always waiting. That's the one to watch out for. Thank you. Please, other reflections or comments?
Kathy?
No one else is? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Kathy?
Hi. Thank you for the courage of this talk. And what I wanted to say is that in my experience, delusion on all levels is the most difficult of the hindrance or of the greed, hatred, delusion. The kalesis. That it almost always takes someone else, regardless of what the delusion is. And it is why we need Sangha so desperately, because so it took the police to convince me to quit drinking. And that was an awfully long time ago. But I see so many other delusions crop up in my family. And it is the people that I am closest to who help me see where I am deluded.
Great. Thank you. That's why I titled this talk, you know, Denial, Friendship, and Recovery, you know, like kind of a formula, you know, denial plus friendship equals recovery. Because, and here we mean friends who have enough courage to say things you don't want to hear. You know, like when I met with my, you know, my Dharma friends from the Sangha, they had no way of knowing whether I had, that I had already, you know, gone into recovery and begun to fully acknowledge the extent of my difficulty, you know, because if I hadn't, they were still going to say, you know, we think there's a problem here. We think you're in trouble and we want to help. So, yeah, just like you said, it takes a certain kind of friend. It takes a courageous friend to be able to help you see that which you otherwise don't want to see. You know, so like I was saying, in my particular case, the gravity of the situation and my desire to heal, to become, you know, whole again, was, you know, the original impetus, the Kalyanamita, was basically the Dharma, you know, within me, that, you know, that kind of inner wisdom and that experience of myself that was able to say, wake up, you're in real trouble here and you really got to do something. But it took friends to basically likewise come and say, yeah, you know, we're here for you, we know how hard this is. And it's the kind of thing that we best do when we do it together. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a good friend, you know, and it takes a certain level of trust. It takes a certain amount of courage on both parts to help you see things you don't otherwise want to see, but you really need to insofar as your own well-being is concerned. Absolutely. Anybody else? Anyone else wants to share something?
I do, Tara Lloyd. One, I want to acknowledge you for speaking the truth and the challenge of that, and so thank you. And I look at it like the ego always makes yourself right, even when it's completely ridiculous, And so the battle is always with that, and the fundamental challenge is our own ignorance and ego, and we have to be continually vigilant, and having a qualified teacher, whether that's a physical person who could call you on it or your friends and sangha and all that, I think that's a necessary part of the formula to be successful in the path.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate the affirmation. Right.
Yeah. And I think when one takes that path, that creates space for oneself and also space for others to also, see what's true for them and to be, and to see what is actually the Dharma or the path. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we call it the Dharma. It's like Jesus of Nazareth said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. It's just not like a light switch. You don't suddenly, see the light and everything's hunky-dory after that. There's the clouds pass over the moon, and then they pass away, and so they're, I can recognize, I can see these periods. Understand that there are these periods where there is obscuration, where it's like, wow, all I really know right now is that I can't see very well, and that I have faith that greater clarity is going to be possible soon. Yeah, well done, appreciate it. Well, and just for talk posting purposes, I'd appreciate it if you could take down the talk from July 11th if it's been posted, and make sure this one goes up instead. Thank you. Other stuff.
Julia, did you want to say something?
Yes, thank you. I took a course on a Buddhist, 12 steps under the auspices of the Shambhala Center.
Yes.
Whom is Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was a raging alcoholic and chaser. And, he quoting him, he says there are three kinds of addiction. The most obvious destructive ones, heroin and cocaine and all that, and kind of unacceptable ones. And then there's the socially acceptable ones, a bit of alcohol, a little caffeine, cigarettes, sugar, etc. And then the more subtle ones have been brought up by many of your wonderful students and self here. The belief that, beliefs, false beliefs in regards to Dharmic. We know them all. I don't have to elaborate on them. But, another thing that Chogyam Trungpa said, that not to absolve himself, but to give us a deeper thought into it, or to absolve anyone else, or to encourage drinking, he said, alcohol or drinking Any attempt to transcend this boring, petty, frustrating, samsaric level of existence is a good thing.
Yep.
So, I'm welcome to hear any comments about that. You know, the basic impetus there of wanting to transcend is a good thing, not the drinking itself. You know, that's. But on the other, you know, we're all trying to get back to the lap of the mother. That's home. That's deep satisfaction. And it's a faulty way of doing it, but we don't know any better. Some people, well, we do in this group. We know better, but, well, always forgive. Forgive yourself. Well,
sure. It's right. You know, it's the encounter with dukkha. What do you do about it? You know, the Dalai Lama said once, you know, we seek pleasure when we cannot find happiness. And that pleasure principle that or is a substitute for happiness. And so it's looking for ways to please oneself, to comfort oneself when there is a fundamental lack of happiness or fulfillment going on. My first exposure to Buddha Dharma actually was in 1971. In the Pali Ballroom on the Berkeley campus, UC Berkeley campus, and Choyam Trungpa was giving a talk there, and we're sitting pretty close to the front, and I watched the guy put away a fifth of sake while he was giving his talk. And so I think there, part of me, you know, when my drinking was starting to get serious, you know, said, well, I'm never gonna talk and give a talk on the influence of alcohol, but you know, well, Trungpa could do it. And so that turned out to be a pretty unskillful view. David Chernikov is a member of Trungpa's Sangha in Boulder for several years, and finally just had to leave, and it was Trungpa's drinking, and said the real problem was that, you know, he was a crazy wisdom teacher, and that, you know, so let go of your preconceptions about how life is or how it's structured. You know, you need to shatter all that in order to be able to see fresh and new. And David said, well, you know, the problem with that Sangha and the crazy wisdom path is, he said, so many of the people there, they got the crazy part down, but not so much the wisdom part. You know, maybe Trungpa could pull it off, but they couldn't. So they would just sit around getting smashed all the time, you know, and thinking that that was, you know, a path to enlightenment. There was a woman I knew when I first came to Colorado. Her name was Barbara Meyer. She was pretty high up in Trungpa circle in Boulder. I don't know if she's still there or not anymore. She was also once married to Jerry Garcia, the guitar player. And she realized what was going on, and she decided to start a 12-step program within the Boulder, you know, the Dharma Datu there, and she caught and it caused a tremendous schism within that Boulder Sangha, because there were some who, with her, recognized that it was a real problem, you know, and that maybe Trungpa could pull it off, but they sure couldn't, and that being addicted to alcohol was really getting in the way of her being able to take in everything the Dharma had to offer. So she eventually just wound up having to leave the group because there was so much resistance to taking that in. I saw a film once. It was a story. It was a film about the life of Trungpa Rinpoche. After he died, he was in Nova Scotia. There was the High Lamas, the tradition in Tibet, is there's this kind of casket or cask they put the body in, and it's packed with salt, okay, that has the effect of desiccating the body. And The vault is held upright, and what are called the relic salts, which is the moisture that was in the body as it drains out, drains through these salts, and it's this very opaque liquid. And so then the understanding is that it's called the 49 days of the Bardo. It's this period of time during which consciousness has left the body and it's wandering before it alights again, or achieves full freedom. And then at the end of the 49 days, then they bring the body. And so there was this guy that I heard give a talk who is part of the Boulder group. His job was to take some of the relic salts from Nova Scotia back to Boulder. And he said when he was going through customs coming into the United States, he had this big urn with this relic salts in it. And they said, he said, we x-rayed it, it's too opaque, we can't see anything through it, open it up, we need to see what's in there. And he said, you don't want me to do that. He said that he explained to them very carefully what was going on, and they were having none of it. And so finally he had to open it up, and he said it was like this slowly moving mushroom cloud. It was kind of backing off in every direction, and he proceeded on the boulder after that. And then I watched the film of his cremation, and it was pretty amazing. You can see it on the film. It's a clear day, and there's the funeral pyre, and it's just getting hotter and hotter, and the flames are going up. And then all of a sudden, there is this rainbow that appears over the top of the pyre. Just there, just for a couple of seconds, but you can see it, you know, really clearly, kind of like the aurora borealis. And Bob Thurman, the Tibetan Buddhist scholar, said, "Yeah, I think it's all the ethanol." So yeah, Trungpa was able to pull it off, but that doesn't mean it's a wise path. It's just it was his path. You know, the reason he had a limp is that he was driving really drunk when he was a young guy in England and ran into a building, and you know. So at any rate, and you know, other kind of heartbreaking stories. You know, Alan Watts was just really profound teacher. He did a wonderful job of helping us who were just on the doorstep of looking at the wisdom traditions of the East. He was a masterful kind of translator, you know, kind of a Gnostic intermediary. Really moving talks, really helped a lot of us. Drank himself to death. You know, it happens. It is a medical condition that will take you out if you don't figure out how to heal from it. So, and I think that, you know, in my particular case, the recovery program that I'm in feels right for me. But I think any recovery program, and this is what I noticed, you know, that my limited success at the VA, there needs to be some means by which the spiritual aspects of the healing process are acknowledged and trained and included, you know. And so that happens in different ways for different of us. You know, there was for years there was a meeting, a 12-step meeting at the Denver Zen Center, and so there were people from different Buddha Dharma Sanghas around town, Tibetan and Zen and Vipassana, who would attend this Monday night meeting. And I was asked to come give a talk there once. And during the Q&A, I think we'd been talking about notions of not self in the different Dharma traditions. And then the question arose, well, if there's no self, then who's addicted, right? So we we need to kind of sit with that for a little while and figure out what was going on there. And I remember one of the people saying, and we're talking about empty nature itself and whatnot, he said, you know, I think that's a real nice, elegant teaching and whatnot. He said, but at 3 o'clock in the morning, when every cell in my body is crying out for a drink, emptiness doesn't quite get it. So you need to decide which of the teachings and practices are most relevant to your needs at the time. And so then we started to start talking about metta, you know, about that the awakening to the nature of this condition within the Buddha Dharma context, since it's a form of dukkha, a powerful source of dukkha, right? It also draws forth compassion, you know, and that's the practice for 3 a.m., which is to say, oh, wow, here I am. This is dukkha, you know, and I know dukkha, and like Sharon Salzberg and so many others say, you know, in this tradition, you know, suffering is the gateway to compassion. Being completely honest and open about the nature of the dukkha you're suffering naturally calls forth the compassionate heart to be with the suffering. And so that's also in my experience where being able to step out of denial and be upfront has had that effect, you know. It's sprout forth a compassionate regard for myself that when I was in denial about the alcoholism, not only was in denial about the alcoholism, I was in denial about the extent to which it had really eroded my kind of healthy sense of self or true self. It had eroded my faith in my essential goodness, my Buddha Dharma, my inner kind of the Buddha within, the one who knows. It's like it was estranged. I couldn't touch it. I couldn't hear it, you know, because I was pretending I didn't have a problem when I did. And there's something about acknowledgement, right? This is here. This is suffering. Then here comes the compassion. That's how it works. right. So other stuff. Anyone else have a comment or a reflection? Very well. So thanks for dropping by, listening to my story.
You were sharing it.
I know we all have ours to share. I've heard somebody say once, you know, well, we're all in recovery, we're all addicted to something. And I don't really think that's true. You can find a lot of things to lean on when you're in real trouble, but addictive behavior and true addiction is, in my experience, something different. It's not something that we all have dukkha, but we all don't necessarily find ourselves in the matrix of addiction. But there is healing that we all are called upon to engage in, whether or not it includes, you know, addiction or not. That's why the Buddha taught the Dharma, because we all suffer. We're all capable of experiencing the cessation of suffering. He wouldn't ask us to do it if we couldn't do it, just like Joseph asking me to teach. You know, it's there, it's possible, but it doesn't happen without a certain amount of skillful effort. So thanks so much for coming around, everybody. So let's settle in to our sitting postures again. Just before I go our separate ways. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. May I live with ease and know ease of well-being. May I be safe from all inner and outer harm. May I relax into the awakened heart, the heart that is at peace with things as they are. Including the necessary healing that we are all called upon to do. May we be happy. May we be at peace. May we experience well-being and wholeness. And may we awaken.
That was wonderful, Tara Lloyd. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you for opening your heart, Lloyd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thanks, everyone.
Stay safe and be well.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you.
Haya Kon Dharma.
Yeah, there's something very comforting in knowing that your lead Dharma teacher the bottom line is teaching the Dharma is what woke you up. That's comforting. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So denial, friendship, and recovery.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Mm-hmm.